Blog Talk Radio.
The following program is a presentation of the Admiral's Radio Network.
It's time to enter the locker room. The Coach's Show of Michigan Admirals Minor League Football.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Donald Matthews, head coach of the Michigan Admirals and the host of the Locker Room. Tonight we got a very special two-hour show. 25 years ago this month, a special group of people began an endeavor based on the premise that people would watch and enjoy football at any time of the year. The United States Football League bred many stars that went on to great careers. People like Doug Flutie, Herschel Walker, Reggie White, Jim Kelly, the list goes on and on. He gave cities such as Phoenix and Jacksonville and Oakland a chance to prove that they could support professional football. He gave coaches like Jim Mora, Steve Mariucci, and Steve Spurrier a chance to prove that they could coach at a high level. He gave characters of the game like the sack man, John Corker, Eddie Meat Cleaver Weaver, Junior IU, and others a chance to show that they could play this game. Tonight we're going to pay tribute with remembering the United States Football League 25 years later. With me now is Lon Turner, Truck Turner. What's going on, Truck?
Not a whole lot, sir. How you doing tonight?
I'm doing wonderful. Good. I can't complain, not one bit, not one single solitary bit.
Good to hear.
You're one of the oldsters on our team. I'm not going to give away your age or anything.
But I am. I'm not the oldest, though.
But you know, you're kind of up there, and you do remember. You have remembrances of the USFL, and
yeah.
You know, I don't know whether you actually went to Panther ball games.
No, I never made it down to a Panthers game. I mean, hell, I've only been to, I think, two Lions games in my lifetime.
Well, that, you're not missing nothing, trust me.
That's a whole other story. But, no, I remember watching the USFL, you know, when I was a kid. And, you know, I think I was 13. Yeah, I'd have been 12, 13 years old. So I do have some memories of the USFL. You know, I remember having the Michigan Panthers shirt, watching the Panthers. And I believe Anthony Carter was a big star of the Michigan Panthers. He was a star receiver. You know, Herschel Walker and, you know, a lot of those guys.
I was a great Michigan Panthers fan. I was a fan of the league in general, but I particularly love the Michigan Panthers. And I just enjoy having a team that I could cheer for that actually looked like they were going to do something, you know?
Yeah, I could see where that was going.
But I'm trying my best to steer away from that, all right?
I'm really trying my best. You know, at that age, you know, I watched football. I didn't, you know, as far as the, you know, Panthers winning, Lions didn't. I don't even know if I was really even a Lions fan back then. I think I was still in my Washington Redskins phase, coming out of my Steelers phase back then. So,
back during that time, yeah, you have to be Redskins and the Steelers fans, definitely. I'm getting into the spirit of the whole thing tonight. I'm sitting here doing the show tonight. I have my Birmingham Stallions cap on, which I bought quite a few years ago. You know, I bought this before my daughter moved to Birmingham. So, you know, you tell how long that was ago. And little did I know that I would have, you know, a kid down in Birmingham, Alabama when I bought this. I liked the logo, and, you know, and I liked how the team played. So, you know, I ended up buying the hat off the internet. I still have Michigan Panthers stuff. We have a small kid size shirt that my youngest wore. She was about 2 years old during that first season, 1983, and You know, we bought one of those things when we went to the ball games, and we went to quite a few of the ball games. I can remember going to A&W and getting the discount coupon so you can sit in the west end zone. And those are some great times. I mean, not only was the product good, it was just the atmosphere was so much better. And you know, I enjoyed the heck out of it. I watched it every week on television. And a lot of people don't know this, but the United States Football League was the first professional sport to ever be shown on ESPN.
Wow,
that was, you know, that was the turning point for ESPN in terms of being a national network when they started broadcasting Monday night games of the United States Football League. And you know, it's ESPN has evolved more and more since then.
Wow, you know, you hearing you say some of this stuff is like, you know, it's kind of coming back to me now. It's like when ESPN was on for, what, 12 hours a day or something like that?
Well, you know, I think they were on 24 hours a day. It was just that, you know, a lot of their stuff, you know, they did a lot of bowling and a lot of pool. You know, I kind of liken it ESPN back into the way ESPN Classic is now, a lot of the old pool things and stuff like that. That's basically how it was. And, you know, then they started getting into the college basketball and became very proficient at that. But that was their first inroad into broadcasting a professional sport when they did those 3 years of the USFL on Sunday night. And first Monday night game was the Michigan Panthers. They went down to Birmingham to play the Stallions. I still remember this like it was yesterday. I remember the score and everything. It was 9-7. The Panthers won that game with three Novo Bojovic field goals. And they had a pretty good crowd in Legion Field that night. And it was the beginning of something really nice. And I personally think, you know, and I will get, I'm sure, more into this as we move on tonight, but I personally think if they had left things as it was and stayed with the game plan as it was, we would have, you know, I think we would still have spring football. We would still have the United States Football League in some shape or form. They proved that, in my mind anyway, they proved that there was a market for this. And, you know, and people have been trying it ever since to have springtime football. And the latest, of course, has been the All-American Football League, which went belly up last week, you know, before they even actually got to play a game. And it's difficult. It's very hard.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, you saying Novo Bojovic, because I remember watching him kick for the Detroit Drive back in the day. You're just bringing up all – it's like a therapy session. You're just bringing up all these memories that I forgot, all the stuff I forgot about.
It was.
Novo Bojovic, wow.
Novo was quite a character. My wife and son met him in 83. They came to the Holiday Inn, what was the Holiday Inn. And it's I'm not sure what it is now, the hotel over on Pearson Road. It used to be a Ramada. But they brought Novo Bojovic, John Corker, and some cheerleaders, you know, in to try to drum up support, and you know that was real nice. You know, Novo tried to get my son to talk. You know, my son was all of 4 years old then, and he was pretty shy, so he didn't want to talk, not even to Novo. My wife, on the other hand, had no trouble talking with John Corker.
That's funny.
And she liked him a lot. So they carried on conversations like they'd known each other for years. But right. you know my wife a little bit by now. You know that she'll talk to just about anybody.
Yeah, I'm not even going to I'm gonna leave Miss Matthews alone. You know.
Yeah, because you still gotta deal with her. I still gotta deal with her too, but you know.
Yeah,
I still have to put in my digs every now and then.
Yeah, it's just funny hearing that name. That's a name I had forgotten about, and you know, just like I said, it brought back those old Detroit Drive days, like we were talking about the AFL years ago. You know, the two names I remember now are him and Art Schleister. So,
yeah, the Michigan Panthers in '83, and you know that was of course the year that that they won the first USFL title. And at Mile High Stadium in Denver, and you know, I can still remember a lot of the players. You know, of course, you remember the major contributors, you know, like Anthony Carter and Bobby Hebert and Ken Lacy. But a lot of those guys on defense, like John Corker and David Greenwood and people like that. Those are the people that really made that team go. I thought that you know, with the Panthers, They didn't really turn the corner until they kind of raided the Pittsburgh Steelers roster, and they got Ray Penny and Banaszak and Tyrone McGriff.
Wow. You got 83? Okay, yeah, I was 11, so yeah, I really don't remember a lot. you know, most of the guys I remember from the USFL are the ones that, you know, after the USFL, you know, disbanded, that went on to play in the NFL. Those are a lot of the guys that I remember. You know, I remember the Michigan Panthers. I remember them winning the championship. I remember having a shirt, loved the logo, but, you know, I was 11. I think I was still playing with G.I. Joe and stuff. But then again, I feel...
Yeah, like I said, you kind of up there in age, so, you know, you can relate with a little bit of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, a little bit.
What were some of the other teams that you followed and liked, or some of the other players that you liked? At least?
Oh, wow.
And, you know, and don't go easy on me and say Herschel Walker.
Oh, wow. You know, I mean, like I said, being at that age, that time, that long ago, you know, there's a lot of guys I don't remember. I mean, I remember the Houston Gamblers. Wow. I'm completely drawing a blank. You know, I mean, but like, you know, like some of the guys you named, like Jim Kelly, those guys. That, like I said, most of the ones that went to that next level, like you said, Herschel Walker, which you said I couldn't say out because it was easy, but
that's too easy, man.
That's too easy, but that's like I said, those are the guys that really stick out in my head, you know, because they did, you know, go on and you know play in the NFL and actually made an impact, like you know Herschel Walker, you know Anthony Carter, Jim Kelly, you know those guys are, you know. Hall of Famers. So, you know, I gotta digress. You know, to quote Mr. Snorberg. Speaking of, where is Bill?
I have no idea where Bill is, to be honest with you.
Oh boy.
Yeah, you have to ask Boss Lady. She's on the web chat. I definitely like the Houston Gamblers. I thought, man, they were such a fun team to watch. It was just picking up little stuff from them. I was coaching by then. I started coaching in 81. And so I was like a couple of years into my career doing junior high football. And the first time I saw the Houston Gamblers play, it took me one time to watch them play to be hooked. And said, I got to know more about this offense. I got to know how this works. By that fall, I had installed that on my team, and I've been doing some kind of, a form of the run and shoot that the Gamblers have started ever since.
Okay.
They were just fun to watch.
Yeah, and it's effective. I mean, you know, it's proven effective for us. You know, so, I mean, can't knock it, I guess. Wow. That's just so long ago. And, you know, I've been ear-holed a few too many times to remember a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's, there were a lot of teams that were on the cusp, I think, of being real good ball clubs and making the profit and all that. I think only the first year that the United States Football League, in that first year, 1983, only one team had a profit, and that was the Denver Gold. And that was a team that drew very well. They drew 40, 45,000 every week. And, you know, it was tough. It's tough for a beginning football league to make a profit to begin with. But when the USFL started straying from their game plan, from their model that they had by getting in the bidding wars for players, and talk more later on about how they made that fateful decision to move to the fall, which in effect killed them. But let me tell you a little bit about the beginning of the USFL. It was founded by a man named David Dixon, who was an antiques dealer in the New Orleans area. He founded it on May 11th of 1982. The concept of the USFL was born from the mind of this guy who believed that America's appetite for professional football was insatiable. He brought a measure of credibility with his idea. He'd been involved in pro football before, having been instrumental in the founding of the New Orleans Saints, and as well as with the construction of the Louisiana Superdome. He originally conceived this idea in 1965. His concept for the league was shelved for close to a decade and a half. During that time, he followed the paths of two other pro football leagues that come and gone, the American Football League and the World Football League. So, we got somebody calling in here. Let me try to get them aboard here. Hello, you're in the locker room. Who's this?
This is Tim Mazzetti. Who's this?
Hi, Tim. This is Don Matthews. How you doing?
Good, Don. How are you?
Good, good. Ladies and gentlemen, we have Tim Mazzetti on the line, who kicked for 3 years for the Boston, New Orleans, Portland Breakers, all 3 years of the league, and is the answer to a sports trivia question. Who scored the first points in USFL history?
I have no idea. Do you know, Don?
I certainly do. 30-yard field goal by Tim Mazzetti.
So how are you? What's that about? You're commemorating the 25th anniversary of the USFL?
Yes, sir. We want to get your impressions and remembrances of the league. And I'm really interested in sort of what the nomadic nature of the Breakers was, being in one city 1 year, another city another year, and another city the next year. And you were involved in all three of those years. And I wanted to find out exactly what that was like and what leading up to that first game was like.
Well, it is an interesting story, and it's funny. I have to share a side story. I was actually in Boston last night and today, and I just got back into Chicago where I live now. And so, and I was actually with an old friend of mine, not from my football days, but that remembered the Breakers. And so actually earlier today at lunch, I was talking about the fact that in 1983, I was living in Boston and playing for the Boston Breakers in Old Nickerson Field, which was Boston University's football field, right there off of Comm Ave. And but you know, the USFL was a blast. I had played 4 years in the NFL for the Atlanta Falcons, and they had actually traded me to Cleveland, and I didn't want to go play in Cleveland. We won't go there for any of the Cleveland Brown fans that may be on the call. But the USFL offered me a wonderful opportunity to continue my playing career because back in the 80s, you know, when the NFL traded you, you basically were property of whichever team. There was no such thing as free agency. So I remember talking to the folks at Cleveland, and they're saying, you know, if you don't want to play here, you're just not going to play anywhere in the NFL because we own your rights. And so for me, the USFL was a great opportunity to continue my my playing career, and I got to play for a coach that I got to know when I was trying out for the Philadelphia Eagles about 5 or 6 years earlier in 1978, which was Dick Corey. And that was the reason why I went to go play for the Breakers. And it was a little strange to have to play in three different cities and three different venues over 3 years. But it was still a blast. I mean, the core nucleus of the team and Dick Corey and our owner down in New Orleans, Joe Cannizzaro, I mean, they were just class people. We had a great following in all three cities. Boston was great. Loved playing in the Dome in New Orleans, and obviously brought back a lot of memories from when I played for Atlanta against the Saints. And Portland was actually a blast as well out in Oregon. So all I can tell you is it was strange. It was a little bit different, but they did run a first-class organization, and I can tell you that I had a blast. They were three of the best years of my life, so that was a lot of fun.
Take us back to that spring of 1983, before that first game against the Tampa Bay Bandits. What was the atmosphere like? What was the training camp like, you know, leading up to that point?
Well, we actually remember, again, for the folks, the uninitiated, the USFL, the whole game plan for the USFL was to play in the spring until they got a big enough following, and then they were going to try to either break into the NFL or somehow merge or do something, which was how the league folded back in 1985. I think Donald Trump and a number of other owners filed a class action suit against the NFL, and while they won the suit, they were awarded, I think, $3 in damages, and that was kind of the end of it. But the so we were playing in the spring. And so Boston held its training camp, I think, down in Orlando at the, I can't remember, it was one of the local colleges had, we held our training camp down there. And there were a couple of other USFL teams that were in the neighborhood as well, including the Tampa Bay Bandits. And so, because obviously having training camp in the middle of January in Boston would not have been a very productive way to get two-a-days in. So we spent 6 weeks down in the Orlando area doing training camp, and then I think our first game was, we probably stayed in the Orlando area through our first game, which was against the Tampa Bay Bandits in the stadium. It was not obviously the NFL stadium. We played at some other stadium, and I can't even remember which one it was, but one of the major colleges down there. And we had a good crowd. I think there must have been, about 30,000 people for the first game. And it was just a stroke of luck that we happened to take the opening kickoff, and we drove down the field, and 4 minutes into the game, I ended up kicking a 30-yard field goal that was good. And that's how I got the trivia question of being the of scoring the first ever points in the USFL history.
When you went out there to kick that field goal, were you aware that you were about to make history?
No, I mean, again, go back. I having played 4 years in the NFL, and I actually laid off about a year before I went back into the USFL. So I was, as nervous as a cat, like any other ball player. It was my first game out of the box, and I just wanted to make sure I made the darn thing. I had, no thoughts whatsoever whether it was going to be the first points or not. So I was just glad that I made it.
You've had an interesting life as a teenager, leading up to that point. You spent most of your teen years in Brazil, correct?
Yeah, I was born in Connecticut, and my dad took a job with Union Carbide when I was 2 years old and got transferred down to São Paulo, Brazil. And so I moved down there as a kid, as a baby, and grew up there. So I lived there 15 years, did all my schooling down in São Paulo, which is why, by the time I was 4 years old, I had a soccer ball at my feet. By the time I was 10 years old, I was playing for three organized teams, and by the time I was 16, I was offered pro contracts. Of course, my parents wisely said, over our dead body, you better go to school, son. And so, which I did. And then I ended up coming back to the United States, went to school in the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and, you know, came back here to go to college like my brothers did. And my parents and my family was still down in Brazil. And that's kind of how I got into kicking footballs, because down in Brazil I also played for played rugby down there, which was large British influence down in Brazil and Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, a number of the countries down there. And I actually went to a British school when I was going down there, and so rugby was a big game, and I ended up doing a lot of the field goal placements for the rugby team. So the concept of kicking an oblong ball through the uprights was not exactly new to me. And obviously with my soccer skills, you know, I had a strong leg. And so the transition when I went to Penn in my sophomore year and was asked to try out was a pretty easy one. I mean, obviously it takes a lot of practice and a lot of training to get to the level of playing in the NFL. But I did have sort of an early start in my rugby days down in Brazil.
I want you to... say hello to our co-host, Lon Turner. Lon, you got a question for Tim Mazzetti?
Hi, Lon.
Hey, how you doing, sir?
Good.
Good. Oh, wow. That's a question. What were your, you know, any good memories of, you know, playing the Michigan team, you know, here in Detroit at all?
Well, you guys said, you're talking about the, was it the Michigan Panthers?
Yeah, I'm not talking about the Lions.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, didn't you guys win the first championship? Was it you in Philadelphia in the first championship game?
That's correct.
Yeah, I mean, you guys had a great team. And I think we played you guys, and I think we got our you-know-what handed to us. all I remember was there was some really good talent. I mean, I was really surprised. When I went to the USFL, it was kind of a... It was like rolling the die, and like I said, it was an opportunity for me to continue my playing career, because I didn't want to play in Cleveland, and I was surprised at the level of the, you know, talent. I think the biggest difference between a good USFL team like the Philadelphia Stars or the Michigan Panthers, and we had a pretty good year that year. I think that was our only winning season. I think we were 11-7 or something that first year, and one game away from the playoffs, but. I think the biggest difference was that, you know, in the starting 11 on defense and offense, a number of the better USFL teams, you know, could post, you know, as good or pretty good to some of the, you know, decent NFL teams, because we had a number of very strong name players. I mean, Steve Young, Herschel Walker. I mean, you know, you could go down the list. Every team had some pretty damn good players. But I think it was the depth. You know, once you got past the starting 11, then there wasn't the same kind of depth that you had in a number of the NFL teams, where you very often had, you know, your backup players were almost as good and were constantly vying for a starting position. So I think that was the biggest difference between the two leagues. But like I said, a lot of fun, and playing Michigan, you know, it was, I tell you what, my memories from the USFL were great. A lot of fun.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I want to ask you about one of your teammates, and when he came to into the United States Football League and came to the Breakers, there was such a big commotion about him. I'm talking about Marcus Dupree.
Yeah, the $6 million man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think like? I mean, I think he got paid a lot of money. I think maybe it wasn't $6 million, but he was definitely in the eight figures. And he was one of the nicest kids when he came over. I think he was only a sophomore. I think he only played a year. I think he played his freshman year at Oklahoma and set all sorts of records. I mean, the kid was a horse. I think he was about 6'2", 225 pounds, and ran like a gazelle. It was just amazing. And one of the nicest kids, and it was very unfortunate. I don't know if you all remember what happened to him, but I remember being on the sidelines in one of the opening, and early on in the season, when he made a cut, no one touched him. It was on a grass field. It wasn't even on an AstroTurf field, where he just made a cut, and you could literally see his knee buckle out, and he just destroyed his left knee, and that was it. And it was really sad, because the kid was one of the most talented running backs I have ever, you know, had the privilege of playing with, and that includes, you know, the likes of O.J. Simpson and Sweetness Walter Payton, and, you know, you go down the list. I mean, this kid probably, you know, without that injury, might have had just a phenomenal career. I mean, he was along the lines of an Eric Dickerson. I mean, that's how fast and how talented he was. And big, too. I mean, at 225 back then, that was, and with his speed, that was just a very large running back. So,
yeah, it was a shame what happened to him, because he had tons of potential.
Oh, gosh. To watch him run even in practice was just a pleasure. And again, he was just a nice kid. He was fun to be around. So, yeah, that was sad. That really hurt, too.
Yeah.
Do you know what he's doing now? I mean, I haven't stayed in touch with him, but you guys obviously have done a good job of trying to track down some of us. Do you know what he's doing lately?
I have no idea. You know, it really stops at one point where he's I believe in Georgia, but you know, I was never able to track him down any further.
Well, I knew he was from Mississippi originally, but I lost track of him after a few years. And the only good news was I think he had a guaranteed contract, so at least he made some good money out of it.
And that's very true. You talked earlier about Dick Corey, your coach, and he was
coach
all 3 years. What kind of coach was he?
Well, you know, if you were to, you know, divide up coaches into two types, if you will, one which is what I would call a player's coach, and one who is like, you know, an author, a general, you know, running a boot camp, Dick definitely fell into the player's coach. And the players loved him. We all loved playing for him. And that's why I think I had so much fun. I mentioned most of these USFL teams were a combination of veteran NFL players who were either, you know, brought on board or defected to the USFL like I did, and had a, you know, good experience and had played for some, you know, some strong NFL teams, and then some younger players either, you know, that were drafted or brought into the USFL. And so a lot of us older players for Dick Corey really were like player coaches in a sense. So, you know, I was the captain of the special teams. I used to be very involved in, you know, making sure we had you know, the punter, myself, and we had the right practice schedule, and you know, it was a lot more involved than it may have been in the NFL, and also even a little bit more casual. Maybe that was Dick's style, but it was just a lot of fun. I just remember, you know, comparing to the 4 years I played for Atlanta, where I had a lot of fun, but it felt like playing in the NFL and playing for Atlanta was a lot more pressure. And maybe it was because I walked away from the game and then came back into it, so I appreciated it more. But the combination of playing for Dick Corey and being more involved in the team, and being older and being a veteran, I think all those elements, you know, contributed to being just a great experience.
In the 3 years, you know, and I realize there are so many great players that came out of the USFL, but in those 3 years, what players, few players that you saw that you looked at them and went, wow?
Well, you know, other than Marcus Dupree, who actually, you know, played with us, you know, some of the guys that I had actually, and one of the guys that really stuck out, and I knew him fairly well, because when I was playing in Atlanta a few years earlier, I was also doing television sports reporting work for the ABC station in Atlanta, WSB. And I used to cover Herschel Walker when he started with University of Georgia up in Athens. And so, you know, I got to know Herschel as a rookie or as a freshman and then a sophomore. And I think he came to the USFL after his sophomore season. And, you know, you want to talk about a tremendous athlete. But again, he had, you know, probably one of the most gifted athletes I've ever met. The guy was just, I don't know how to describe him. He was, you know, and you know, he was straight. He never partied, never drank. He worked his ass off. So he wasn't just gifted, but he really worked at it. And one of the nicest, most humble men I've ever met. And, you know, there's a guy that, and he ended up obviously playing many, many years in the NFL. And then there were guys, you know, Steve Young played for the LA team, and he was great. There, you know, those are the players that really stuck out. Doug Flutie, and a handful of others. I mean, even Bobby Hebert for the Philadelphia Stars as a quarterback. And I can't remember who was the Michigan quarterback, Lou, do you remember?
Yeah, Hebert was the Michigan quarterback.
Oh, Hebert was the Michigan quarterback. Who's the quarterback for the Stars?
Chuck Pivilina.
Okay. I mean, there was some, you know, there was some good, solid talent there. We always used to speculate, you know, if we took some of the top teams in the USFL and put, you know, put them up against an NFL team, how we would fare. And our guess was that we could, you know, again, as long as the first team was in there, that we would probably do pretty good, but that over time, we, you know, if we had to play a whole season, we'd probably lose out because we didn't have the depth.
Mm-hmm. What position in that league did you think that was as strong as that they had the most talent in that league?
Well, I think, you know, I think the biggest difference between the USFL, again, every team had, like I said, a number of NFL players, including some real all-out standout stars like the Herschel Walkers and Steve Youngs and et cetera. I think where it was more difficult was certainly, you know, if you took some of the offensive or defensive lines, you know, the all-pro lines that some of the NFL teams had put together, and that's probably where you would start seeing a difference, where we might have a really good guard or a tackle, but we were not strong across the whole line. Those were more difficult players to both recruit as well as, you know, train and what have you. And that's really where the NFL's farm system and being able to draft some of the best out of the college and being able to bring them up for a few years, mentor them and, you know, get them into a starting rotation, that's really where the farm system in the NFL, you could see the difference. At the skill level, you know, running back, receiver, even quarterback, you know, place kicker, punter, some of the, you know, linebackers and cornerbacks, you know, you could... The skill level, you could pick up and bring in some of those players, and that's exactly what the USFL try to do. They try to draft or buy some of the name players. It was at the line level that I think you would have probably seen the biggest difference.
Okay, last question for you, Tim. What has Tim Mazzetti been doing since he retired?
As little as possible. Only kidding. The best thing that probably happened to me playing in the USFL amongst a number of things was the owner of the New Orleans Breakers and Portland Breakers was a very successful commercial real estate developer down in New Orleans called Joe Cannizzaro. And when Joe found out that, you know, I had gone to school and had a finance background, he said, you know, if you're interested, why don't you come work for me in the off season in my development company and learn the real estate business? And that was back in 1983-84, and I did. And I've been in commercial real estate and now in commercial real estate finance ever since. So been working very, very hard. But, you know, commercial real estate's been great for me. It's been my career for the last almost 25 years since 1984. And I now make my home in Chicago. I'm a partner in a national commercial real estate finance mortgage banking firm called Cohen Financial that's based here in Chicago. And it's, you know, that's what I do for a living. You would never know. I wear my coat and tie and I go about making a living, and it's been great. But again, the memories from my NFL and USFL days are also wonderful. So it's been fun talking to you guys, Don. Thanks for having me on your show.
Hey, I want to thank you for calling in tonight. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Absolutely. I'm glad you reached out and called me.
All right. Have a good night.
Okay, you guys have a great one. Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
That was Tim Mazzetti, the former New Orleans, Portland, Boston Breaker kicker. Like I said, he was the answer to a trivia question line, who kicked the first points in the United States Football League, and he did it against the Tampa Bay Bandits down in Florida with a 30-yard field goal. And he was a very good kicker for the Falcons before he came to the United States Football League. So, you know, he's had a long career, and, you know, he has very fond memories of the USFL.
Yeah, that was interesting, you know, hearing him talking about, you know, his soccer and rugby background. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, a lot of people give kickers grief. But, I mean, you know, those that do come up from soccer background, soccer players are some of the best athletes, most well-conditioned athletes you want to see. So, you know, that was kind of interesting. You know, something I never would have thought that he would, you know, had grown up in Brazil.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting, different too, that, you know, he spent basically his entire childhood from age 2 to 17 in Brazil and, you know, and was a great soccer player in Brazil. So, you know, and that really helped him out when he came back to the U.S. and basically walked on to the University of Pennsylvania team and became their kicker and moved on to the Atlanta Falcons. He did 3 years with the Falcons and 3 years with the Breakers and had a pretty successful career. That was real nice to talk to him. I was hoping that, you know, that he would be the first one to call in because I really wanted to get his perspective, you know, having played all 3 years in the USFL with, you know, how things were, how things were run. And, you know, and I've talked to some guys by email, and they pretty much say that, you know, there was really particularly – early on in 1983 season, that there was really no difference between how things were run in the USFL teams and how the NFL teams were run. You know, I can remember one quote by Carl Peterson, who was running the Philadelphia Stars in all 3 seasons that they were in the league, and now he's with the Kansas City Chiefs. And when he got with the Chiefs and saw how the Chiefs were run, he knew that what he did with the Stars was moving them in the right direction, you know, because there was not a whole lot of a difference between the two organizations in terms of how they were run.
Right, and I think if, you know, if they hadn't decided to try to take the NFL head on and play, you know, fall, it may have actually even turned into maybe not so much of a merging, but like, you know, maybe almost like a developmentally, you know, where, okay, you know, kind of like hockey has the IHL or, you know, whatever, you know, or like they had NFL Europe, you know, where, you know, they send players, okay, we want to see what you do, you know, you need more work. And it could have been some, you know, NFL affiliation, you know, especially, you know, with them saying, with what you're saying, and players saying there was really no difference. That makes for a lot easier transition, you know, going from a USFL team to an NFL team.
Yeah. Got another caller in. Let's get him on the line. Hang on just a second. Hello, you're on the locker room.
Yeah, this is Kyle Whittingham calling in.
How you doing, Coach?
I'm doing well. I guess this is the spot I was supposed to call in at, so...
I do appreciate it. Kyle Whittingham, ladies and gentlemen, the head coach at the University of Utah, is calling in, and we definitely thank him for doing that because you're in the middle of a recruiting thing, aren't you? You're out on the West Coast.
Yeah, I'm out here in California, but actually we wrapped up recruiting in February about a month and a half ago as far as the 08 class, but you know, recruiting never stops, so now we're working on the 09 guys. And you know, recruiting is a 365-day-a-year proposition.
Yeah, that's very true, very true. Coach, you played in the United States Football League. Tell a little about what you did there and how that was.
Well, it was a great experience. You know, I was an undersized guy and really – you know, the NFL is you know, I got kicked out of their computers, you know, being 5'11 and, you know, 225 pounds. And so it was a great opportunity for me to continue my career and have a chance to play, you know, a few more years, and had a great time doing it. You know, it was a, you know, an upstart league, and had a chance to play for Red Miller, you know, that first year in 83, I believe it was. And so nothing but positive memories and positive experience in the USFL.
You played for the Denver Gold in 83, correct?
I did. I was in Denver in 83 and then got traded to the New Orleans Breakers in 84. And then they moved to Portland in 85. And, you know, so I was in league for a couple of years. And you know, like I said, I had a great experience, met some good people, and had a chance to, you know, play for a guy named Jimmy Carr with the Gold, who was a heck of a guy and, you know, an old NFL coach. And you know, like I said, it was just a great opportunity for a guy like me to be able to keep playing for a couple more years.
Yeah, we just got to be talking to one of your ex-teammates, Tim Mazzetti.
Oh, yeah, a kicker. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember him very well. Yeah, he was, I think he had kicked with the Falcons prior to joining the USFL, and if I remember correctly. And heck of a kicker. I remember that. It seems like he had a you know, pretty decent NFL career prior to arriving in Denver with us.
Now, in that 83 season, as you said, you played for the Denver Gold. That was a team that drew very well there, had great fan support in 83. What was that like playing Mile High Stadium?
No, it was great. It was great. I think we opened up to 30,000 or 35,000 thereabouts with our home opener, and I think you can attribute a lot of that to Red Miller. I mean, he had a great name in Denver and had done such a great job with the Broncos. You know, that gave the franchise instant credibility when Red was named the coach. And you know, like I said, it was great memories, and, you know, it was a spring league, so it was a little bit different in that respect. It was a March through June or July was our time frame that we played, and you know, it was just a good experience. You know, some quality people in that league too. I mean, Herschel Walker started out in that league, and Steve Young, and Kelvin Bryant. You know, there's a bunch, Sam Mills. I mean, there was a bunch of guys that went on to have very, very good NFL careers that started out in that USFL.
I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Tim a few minutes ago. Take us back to that few weeks before the league started in 1983. And what was that like preparing for that first ever game?
Well, first of all, I was in the Bronco training camp in 82. In the fall of 82, the Denver Broncos assigned me as a free agent. And you know, I got cut somewhere in the middle of training camp, and so I thought really my career was over with. And I got a phone call, you know, a few weeks later from a team, you know, called the Denver Gold, which I had never heard of, never heard of the league. You know, they were telling me how this was an upstart league, and they were getting ready to put this thing together. And the more I heard about it, the more it interested me. And then, you know, we went to training camp in Phoenix, Arizona, where we trained that first year. And we were, you know, back then the league was brand new, obviously, and so there were no preseason games. I think we were in training camp for six straight weeks without having a game. I mean, we had, you know, a few scrimmages against some other teams, but it was a long grind, that training camp. But then I remember, you know, the opening game, I can't remember exactly who we played. I want to say it was the Tampa Bay franchise, but I can't remember for certain. But I remember that first game. It was a great experience, you know, playing in front of those rabid Denver fans. I mean, they love football over there in Denver, and they had Red Miller had a great following that he had built when he was with the Broncos, and so that was a great experience getting ready for that game.
I want you to say hi to our co-host, Lon Turner. Lon, say hi to Coach.
How you doing there?
Hey, good. How you doing?
Not too bad.
You got a question for Coach Whittingham?
Yeah, it's kind of a piggyback on the question that you asked Tim Mazzotti. What, in your eyes, were the big differences between the USFL and the NFL, you know, at that time?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, a guy that maybe was missing something, a little bit of speed, a little bit of height, a little bit of, you know, whatever that was missing in that player had a chance to keep playing. I think that, you know, the NFL is you know, there's so many good players in that league, and it's such a competitive league. I think the big thing was it offered guys like I said, myself and some other guys that maybe didn't quite fit those NFL standards, a chance to play on. And, you know, like I said, Sam Mills, you know, had it not been for the USFL, my guess is Sam Mills would have never had a chance to break in the NFL because he would have been stereotyped as too small to play. And, you know, we all know what kind of career he had for the Saints. He was a great player. And I think it gave a lot of guys like that an opportunity to demonstrate what their capabilities were and launched them into an NFL situation.
I'm going to talk a little bit about switching a little gears here and maybe come back to USFL in a moment, but I want to talk about University of Utah and your schedule coming up. With us being from the state of Michigan, we happen to notice that University of Utah is on the University of Michigan schedule this year.
Yes, sir, that's our opener.
That should be very good.
We hope it's competitive. We'll find out. I mean, they're a heck of a football team. Of course, they went through the coaching change. They got Coach Rodriguez over there, and I'm sure he's generating a bunch of excitement. You know, we expect that place to be filled to capacity, as it always is, the big house there on August 30th, and a ravenous crowd. And I think it's going to be a great experience for our players. We did play back there about 6 years ago. I think it was 2002 we went back there. I've been at Utah a long time. I've been there 15 years. And so I think it was 2002 we took our team back there and lost 10-7 in a hard-fought defensive battle. So I've been there personally before, but none of the players on our current team have had a chance to go there. And so this is going to be a great experience for our guys.
Yeah, as you said, you've been at Utah for quite a long time. And you moved up the ranks there from defensive line coach to defensive coordinator. You replaced your father as defensive coordinator, as I recall. And
yes, I did. That's correct.
And in 2005, you became the head coach. What was that like replacing Urban Meyer?
Well, I'll tell you what. Not only replacing Urban, but, you know, following a 12-0 season. I mean, that was the big deal. Is, you know, the bar was set high and, you know, really nowhere to go from as far as upward mobility from there. You can't get any better than 12-0, and we had a heck of a run that year. Urban Meyer's a heck of a football coach, one of the best I've ever been around. But, you know, I knew what I was getting into. I knew that, you know, the fans were patient and realistic, that, you know, we were going to build something there and continue with the winning ways. We lost about 92% of our offensive production off that 0-4 team that went undefeated. So we knew that we were, starting over in a lot of respects. It wasn't a complete rebuilding project. I don't want to make it sound like that, but we had a chance to, get something going. We won 7 ball games in 05 and then 8 ball games in 06 and 9 ball games last year. So, and coupled with 3 bowl wins in a row. And so we think we're heading in the right direction and building this thing back up. And I'm excited about the 08 season. Like we mentioned, we opened with Michigan and got Oregon State coming into our place and playing in that Mountain West Conference. It's a challenging schedule, and, you know, TCU and some of those teams that we play year in and year out. So I think we're heading in the right direction. We're excited for the 08 season. We got a great senior quarterback, Brian Johnson, who will be leading the team this year, and he was hurt for most of last year, but we got him back full strength this year. So we're excited to get this thing going and see how good we are.
I got to put you on the spot here, Coach. A lot of people continue to talk about the BCS and the what's good about it, what's bad about it. Do you ever see anywhere on the horizon a playoff?
I think it's inevitable. I don't think it can be avoided. There's too many people that want it. There's too much, bottom line is most things are driven by the dollar, and there's too much money being left on the table, in my opinion, to not have a playoff system. I think, what that system is debatable. Is it an 8-team playoff? Is it a 16-team playoff? So I don't have the perfect scenario of how to put it together. But, college football is huge. And the money generated and the interest generated from a playoff system would be off the charts. I mean, you think the March Madness is big, this would be, double that. And I think that ultimately it's going to happen.
I like how he thinks, Lon.
Yeah.
Great minds think alike.
it's sounding like you would prefer to have a playoff system.
Absolutely, no question about it. '04 is a perfect example. We'll never be able to know how good we were. I mean, we ran the table during the regular season and beat Pitt, who I think was ranked 20th at the time, in our bowl game, the Fiesta Bowl. And we would love to have had the opportunity to keep playing and line up and see how we would have fared against Auburn or SC or whoever we would have ran into. But But, you know, that's and, you know, college football, as you guys well know, has been stated many times, the only major sport that is not decided on the field. I mean, the champion is not decided on the field in a true playoff situation. It's a, you know, it's a situation that I don't understand why that is. I mean, you know, why is every other sport, you know, involved with a playoff system and not Division I football? So I think in the next, I'm going to say 4 to 6 years, you're going to see it put in place.
What did you think about the All-American Football League and what they were trying to do and the fact that they're having to postpone their season until next year?
You know, to be honest with you, I don't know a whole lot about it. I just know that, you know, any league that can get up and off the ground is a healthy situation, in my opinion. I think that, you know, any league that gives more players more opportunities to play ball, I think, is a good thing. The Arena Football League has done very well. We got a franchise in Salt Lake that's doing very well in arena football. So I think that any opportunities that are out there for the athletes is a positive.
All right. Lon, you got any more questions?
None that I can think of.
I appreciate you guys. Appreciate you guys having me on very much so. And, you know, if there's nothing else, then I'll let you guys go.
All right, Coach,
okay.
I want to thank you for calling in.
No problem. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. All right, that was Kyle Whittingham, the head coach of the University of Utah, who played 2 years in the United States Football League with the Denver Gold in 1983 and the New Orleans Breakers in 1984. And these guys have real fond memories of playing in the league. And really, what I think is the theme that is running through this line is that giving players another chance to play, you know, to play the sport that they love.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, people not, you know, that not like, say, arena football, arena two, you know, CIFL, even minor league football. It's just, you know, there's guys, there's people, like even at our level, that, you know, we don't get paid, but we just love to play the game. And then that also offers exposure to athletes that may not have gotten that exposure otherwise. You know, like, you know, in the case of like Mike Lewis and of Charleston Hughes, to where they, you know, they get noticed. And, you know, they have a chance to move on to that next level. And without all these, you know, with these other leagues, like, you know, it wouldn't, those opportunities might not be there for them.
Yeah, very true. We're going to take a quick break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk some more on our special program tonight, Remembering the USFL 25 Years Later. We've got a couple of clips that we want to play for you guys related to the league. So, stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Locker Room.
For your insurance needs, visit Admiral sponsor Brook Insurance and Financial Services, located at 2119 Linden Road in Flint. Brook Insurance and Financial Services strive to offer quality insurance coverage, a high level of professional service, and a long-term relationship to their customers. Call Agent Rodney Jefferson toll-free at 877-613-2144 for a quote today.
Hi, this is Ryan Barnhouse, head coach of the West Virginia Crash, and you're listening to The Locker Room on Blog Talk Radio and the Admirals Radio Network.
After Hurricane Katrina, AmeriCorps responded.
Whatever they need us to do, AmeriCorps has the flexibility, and just in our mentality as a program, we're flexible so that whenever a need arises, we can meet it.
AmeriCorps needs your help in your community and throughout the nation. Get involved at AmeriCorps.gov or call 800-942-2677.
Welcome back to The Locker Room on Blog Talk Radio and the Admirals Radio Network. Head Coach Donald Matthews and Lon Turner here tonight to talk about the United States Football League, 25 years since its inception, and there were so many things in the USFL that have been brought into the fabric of professional football today. The two-point conversion, instant replay, those are just two of the things that were directly taken from the United States Football League that is part of the inner fabric of the NFL today, Lon.
Yeah, they're, you know, those two things right there are just very integral parts of the league now. I mean, you can't imagine a game without instant replay now, and you know, the 2-point conversion, you know, just added just that another element to the game that, you know, that's huge now. It's just it's good to see that, you know, the NFL learned something. It, you know, they said, okay, you know what, you know, maybe they weren't too far off with this. You know, maybe we can incorporate this and, you know, see what happens. And then, you know, instant replay, people have their, you know, some people like it, some people don't, you know, but the people that like it when their team, you know, scores or gets a turnover or whatever because of the instant replay, they love it. If a call goes against their team, then they hate it. So, you know, you can't please everybody.
Yeah, very true. I want to talk briefly about one of the teams in the USFL, the Tampa Bay Bandits, that were a very interesting team. They had a guy who went on from the USFL and has had a great career as a college coach, not such a great career as a professional NFL coach, but they had Steve Spurrier as their head coach, and he invented their style of offense that they call Bandit Ball. And not only that, they had as their co-owner Burt Reynolds. And you know, then, and that brought a little star quality to the USFL. The main owner of the team was John Bassett, and this was a guy that was heavily involved in the formation of the league. He was also heavily involved in previous league, the World Football League. He wanted to bring a team to the Toronto in the World Football League, and they were blocked by the legislature in Canada, and that team ended up going to Memphis and becoming the Memphis Southmen. This is a brief clip. This is Burt Reynolds talking about John Bassett, who was one of the best, I think, and most beloved owners in the USFL. If I can get it to go. I might have to come back to that line.
Oh, okay.
Bert, we have a friend in common, the late Johnny F. Bassett. Tell me a memory or two of him.
Greatest man I ever knew. Faced death with... if possible, such dignity and humor and class. I never saw anything like it in my life. And he was an extraordinary entrepreneur, very, very gifted sports management man, great daughter, great tennis player, and I love his son. We were partners in the Tampa Bay Bandits in the USFL and before Donald Trump ruined it. And it was such fun. Gosh, it was fun. And I remember we were in London playing, and John's son, we put him on a kickoff team, just hit him, we thought, but he got killed. He was like a kamikaze. Went down in flames.
Great, well, make sure he sees this.
If John Bassett got sick with cancer at the end of the 84 season and kind of went downhill pretty quick and passed away before the 85 season was over with. It was always my opinion that if Bassett had lived, they probably would have stayed in the spring. He was a strong, strong advocate of the United States Football League staying in the spring. And, you know, and there's a lot of people that when you, we hear the name that love the United States Football League, and when we hear the name Donald Trump, we kind of, you know, spit on the ground, and, you know, really for good reason. I think that Trump is the guy basically that killed that league.
Yes, you know, it's kind of funny hearing, you know, Burt Reynolds bite his tongue about his feelings about Donald Trump. You know, and I had actually, like I said, I'm just getting all these memories to come back. I had actually forgotten that Burt Reynolds was an owner. You know, I mean, I know, you know, knew he was a Seminole, you know, years ago, but I'd forgotten that he was actually one of the co-owners that long ago. Wow.
Yeah, he was right up there. You know, I can remember that they had a horse that would, you know, every time the Bandits would score, the guy would ride around the stadium on the horse. The horse's name was Bandit. And that, you know, it's the atmosphere in Denver and in Tampa Bay was unlike any I have ever seen in professional football before or since. You talked also about how much you liked the Houston Gamblers back in the day. I get this. This is a treat just for you. I found this on the internet. This is a Houston Gamblers commercial that was running on TV back in 1984.
It's a brand of pro football never before seen in the Astrodome. Fast-paced, wide open, run-and-shoot football as only your Houston Gamblers can play it. Don't wait another minute. Get your tickets for the Gamblers' next home game at all Ticketron and Ticketmaster outlets, the Astrodome box office, and the Gamblers' office. Call 664-USFL for all ticket information. 664-USFL. Call now and let the Houston Gamblers put the thrill, excitement, and fun back in your football.
You like that? You ready to go out and play football now?
I've been ready to go out and play football, but yeah, I was expecting them to say Sunday. It sounded like a monster truck commercial almost.
Yeah, that's what it sounded like actually. You know, we're getting a lot of activity on the web chat, and we thank everybody for that. They're having a lot of remembrances, particularly of the Michigan Panthers and Bobby Hebert and Anthony Carter, and, you know, everybody, you know, loves and remembers them. It was a league. They had everything that you need to succeed. You know, they had the people with the deep pockets. They had a television contract, two television contracts. And, you know, once again, that name, Donald Trump, you know, he really, when he bought the New Jersey Generals in 1984, he was the one that really started pushing to get the league to move to the fall. Another thing that, and it's also another trivia question, I guess, if you really wanted to think of it that way. In the 3 years that the United States Football League was in existence in 1983, 84, and 85, each year they were able to sign the Heisman Trophy winner.
Wow.
In 83, they signed Herschel Walker. 84, it was Mike Rozier.
Wow.
85, Doug Flutie. That's a trivia question that is amazing to me.
It's just, you know, I think that speaks volumes on just the type of organization that it was. It's just, you know, to be able to, because, I mean, a Heisman Trophy winner can, you know, almost write his own ticket, you know. I mean, now, you know, nowadays with the draft, I mean, but it's, you know, to be able to get Heisman Trophy winners in a brand new league as opposed to them opting to go with the NFL where they stand to make more money. That just speaks volumes just for, you know, just the type of organization that it was, that these guys, you know, that are voted the top college football athlete every year, you know, would want to go play for them. and it just, you know, Donald Trump just, you know, greedy. You know, he wanted to, it wasn't big enough for him, I guess, and, you know.
There was something else I wanted to touch on, too, before I forget about it. And this is only, to me, this is only a partial list. You know, so, you know, if I forget somebody, you know, forgive me for this. But the United States Football League was not only a cradle for players that was not, may not have been the biggest in the world, like Coach Whittingham said. It was also a cradle for coaches. You know, it was an incubator for coaches that later went on to be pretty successful in the National Football League. Now, and this is just, like I said, just a partial list, but USFL coaches, head coaches and assistant coaches alike that went on and had some great success in the NFL and in college. Jim Mora, who was the coach of the Philadelphia and Baltimore Stars. He went on and had some great seasons with the New Orleans Saints, and he also was the coach for the Indianapolis Colts. Jim Stanley, I think, is still an assistant coach with the Arizona Cardinals. Stanley, of course, was the head coach of the Michigan Panthers during their 83 championship run and also coached them in 84. Jim Fossil is a familiar name. The former coach of the New York Giants was an assistant coach for the Portland Breakers. Marv Levy coached in the USFL with the Chicago Blitz, and he also coached the Chiefs and, of course, had those great championship runs to the Super Bowl with the Buffalo Bills. George Allen, the legendary George Allen, who coached with the Rams and the Redskins back in the day, was the coach of the Arizona Wranglers. Chris Palmer, who once was the head coach of the Cleveland Browns, was the offensive coordinator for the New Jersey Generals. Lindy Infante, the Jacksonville Bulls, the head coach of the Jacksonville Bulls, was head coach of the Green Bay Packers. Well, we also talked about Steve Spurrier, Tampa Bay Bandits, who went on to coach the Redskins and had the great years as coach at the University of Florida, and now doing the same thing at South Carolina. June Jones, familiar name to all of you guys out there, coached the Atlanta Falcons after his stint in the USFL, and coached Hawaii for many years, and now is over at SMU. He was an assistant coach for Houston and Denver. And Black Achievement USA, I did forget that he did kind of make Duke, talking to Steve Spurrier, kind of make Duke into maybe not a power, but at least somebody to stand up and look at, you know. And they, you know how Duke is now. You'll definitely appreciate what he did at Duke and the time he was there. A lot of people don't know that Steve Mariucci did some time in the USFL. We all know Mariucci from the 49ers and you know, and the Lions. You know, we don't want to talk about his time with the Lions.
No.
You agree? But he actually was an assistant coach in 1985 with the Jacksonville Bulls. A lot of people don't know that. So there's a lot, you know, like I said, that's not a full list, but there's a lot of people, a lot of players, a lot of coaches, a lot of executives, actually, that later went on and took their time in the United States Football League and went on to the National Football League and became very successful in their right line.
Yeah, I mean, that's the list. Like I said, I never would have, you know, guessed Mariucci and, you know, Steve Spurrier or Lindy Infante, you know. Yeah, I, you know, like I said, you know, me being the age that I was back then, and it's just hearing those names now, it's like, you know, it's like a roll call of, you know, successful coaches at the collegiate level and the, you know, and the NFL, so. that's a little bit of I'm learning today. I'm learning things. And that's always good.
I like to teach, Lon. I really like to teach. Quickly, the 83 season, and this is a season that we really wanted to focus on, because that was the year that the Panthers went all the way and won the only professional football title in the state of Michigan since 1957. I like to say that because because it makes a certain other team look bad.
Yeah, I've noticed you like to.
1957. But that inaugural season of the United States Football League began on March 6th with five games, including the professional debut of the 1982 Heisman Trophy winner, Herschel Walker, who signed with the New Jersey Generals just weeks before the season started. The Generals made their debut on ABC against the Los Angeles Express. 34,002 fans came into the L.A. Coliseum to watch Walker in action. He rushed for 65 yards and the first touchdown in Generals history, but the Express would win the game 20-15. Like I said, that there were a lot of places in that first season in particular that really supported the USFL and what they were doing. And we're talking about Denver. We're talking about Tampa Bay. We're talking about Michigan eventually, even though they didn't draw very well initially. You could probably put Birmingham in that group too. Non-traditional places that were really trying to show that they could support professional football. And those places, you know, taking Michigan out of the loop for a second, places like Birmingham, and later on when Memphis got their franchise, were really trying to show not only that they could support their local teams, but they're in a bigger picture, were trying to show that they could support professional football, period.
And actually, you know, you said that the Panthers were the last team, you know, since, you know, 57 to win a professional football title. The Detroit Drive won a few Arena Bowls, didn't they?
Yeah, that's true, but, you know, we're talking outdoor football.
Okay.
And, you know, and the Arena Football League was not as big a deal as it is. Now, a lot of people consider Arena Football the fourth major sport now, but back in the day, that was definitely a niche sport. And, you know, the big thing in 83 with the Panthers, they were talking about how – basically what I was saying, you know, how can a team just coming on the scene come up and build something so quickly and win a championship so quickly when there was another team that played in the same building that struggled year after year after year? But that's another story, right, Lon? You keep trying to draw me into the story, man.
No, you're drawing yourself into the story.
That's probably true. I mean, there were so many great players that we talked about earlier that came out of the United States Football League. A lot of people know. And then the truth of the matter is a lot of people don't know that Reggie White started his career in the United States Football League. You'd be surprised how many people think that Reggie White's career started with the Philadelphia Eagles.
Well, you know, that is correct. You know, one thing, you know, kind of going off what you said a second ago, is just that was one smart thing, really smart thing that the USFL did, was they put teams in places where they took a chance on places where there wasn't already a professional franchise, like you know, you said Memphis, like you said Birmingham, and you know, there's, I mean, if you look at a Auburn game or Alabama game, you know, on the weekends, there is a, you know, there's a huge football fan base. In Alabama, for example,
mm-hmm.
You know, the Tennessee Titans, you know, they moved to Tennessee. So there's obviously a market for professional football there. And I think that's something that the USFL was very intelligent. I mean, they had their teams in established, you know, cities, you know, like Detroit, you know, and you know, in Tampa Bay and everything, but they also took chances on questionable cities, you know, where, you know, there may not be a big support, but, you know, we're going to try it anyway. And that's, you know, one thing that I give them a lot of credit for doing.
Absolutely. You know, I forgot to mention two towns that really, because of what they did in the USFL, they were able to get NFL franchises. One is Oakland because the Raiders had fled to L.A. by then. And the support that they gave the Invaders in Oakland really was kind of instrumental in convincing Al Davis to come back from Los Angeles to Oakland.
Yeah, they could just,
and the other one was Arizona. The Wranglers drew very well, even you know, when they made the infamous switching of franchises between them and Chicago, they drew very well, and that opened up the fact for the St. Louis Cardinals to move to the desert there. Hey, number 50's in the house, y'all. What's up, Walt? Walt Jackson, our linebacker, who reminds us that he has a cousin that played for the Memphis Showboats, Henry Gizmo Williams, who took that experience with the Memphis Showboats and turned that into a great career in the CFL, a Hall of Fame career with the Edmonton Eskimos of the CFL.
Wow. See, I had heard of him, you know, being as far as the CFL, but I didn't know he played in the USFL. I tried to get Walt to call in. Walt won't call in. So.
I know, he's a quiet guy. We're going to draw him out one of these days, though. I'm serious. We're going to draw that one of these days. We're looking at the web chat here, and once again, we're getting a lot of activity on our web chat, and thank everybody for doing that. Black Achievement USA says that there are similar correlations between the ABA and the USFL, and he believed that the USFL was heading for a 4-team merger with the NFL if it wasn't for Donald Trump. And that's probably true. It's probably true. I've got a caller, and let's get a caller in here. Hello, you're in the locker room.
Hey, Donald, it's Mouse.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, how about you?
Can't complain.
At 7:15, I'm on 7:15 Pacific.
That's good. That's great. How you doing, man?
Short, old, and overweight, but hanging in. How you doing?
I can't complain. Where are you calling from tonight?
Portland, Oregon.
All right. Everybody, this is a guy that is my coaching hero, my personal coaching hero. Miles Davis, who really was instrumental in the run and shoot offense back in the 80s, and just a legend in the sport. And we want to thank you for calling in tonight.
I appreciate it.
Coach, you did a lot of stuff over a lot of years, but we want to talk basically about your years with the Gamblers and your year with the Denver Gold. The year after that, what was when you came into Houston that year? What was that like?
You know, it was really great. We had a bunch of little flighty receivers that could really run. Great little kids. We had Jimmy Kelly at quarterback, and we had good enough people surrounding him that we were a pretty good football team. Jim certainly was the catalyst of the whole thing. But we had, Ricky Sanders, Richard Johnson, all those kids that went on to play in the NFL that were also great. And, you know, I think what we were doing at that time was a step ahead of what most people were doing on offense. And Jimmy set every record in pro football at that time. And the league was great. We had a lot of great owners. It was a lot of fun. And that's what the thing's all about. And then from that point, when we went under, the old players didn't go under. The majority, or not the majority, but over 125 players went into the NFL. So it was a very good league.
What was it like coaching Jim Kelly?
Kelly was a great one. I had a great relationship with Jim, and he's one of those kids that you can't help but like. He was a strong personality and a tough kid. All his brothers are linebackers, and they were a great support system. And Jimmy was a fun-loving kid at that time and became a great man as he progressed through the Buffalo Bills and onto his retirement. You can't say enough good things about Jimmy.
Coach, I want you to say hi to our co-host, Lon Turner. Lon will probably tell you I speak of you reverently often in practice.
Is he lying to you, Mr. Turner?
No, he speaks very, very, very highly of you. It's a pleasure to be on the call with you, sir.
Well, I appreciate it. You know, I had a little kid by the name of Lonnie Turner that played for me. In fact, he just called. He recruited a couple guys for me out of L.A. this last year. The Turner has a soft part in my heart, too, just like the Kellys. The Turners have a soft part.
Oh, that's good to know. That's good to know. I'm being consistent with all the callers tonight. What, in your eyes, was the biggest difference between the two leagues, the USFL and the NFL? And where do you think the USFL could have gone if everything hadn't, gone the way?
Well, the single biggest difference. Well, there's several differences, but the single biggest difference was that NFL had been established long enough that obviously they had more consistency throughout their lineups. We had some great players, like, say, over 100 kids go on and play in the NFL, so we had some very good teams. I think the other thing was the establishment of the NFL, and from the owner to the general manager to the director of player personnel to all those people were a more of a set hierarchy. In the USFL, we were trying to establish that, so from a coaching standpoint, it really was more fun to coach in the USFL than it was the NFL. Now, the ownership has a lot to do with that. I coached in Detroit in the NFL, and Mr. Ford was a great guy and gave us great opportunity. And we had Russ was our GM that did a great job for us, too. But still, people were trying to fight to gain the control from different hierarchies. And I think that's what happens in the NFL. Now, if you're Bill Parcells or Dan Reeves or some of those guys that got control of their situation, there probably wasn't much difference from a coaching standpoint. That's what I'm talking. That's all I know. But both leagues have great players. Both leagues were a lot of fun to coach in, and it was too bad that at the point that the USFL took on the NFL, that we didn't have enough pizzazz to get any franchises for the owners. I mean, it was too bad, but hey, that's how she goes.
Talk about your receivers you had at Houston, the Mousketeers.
Oh, we had some great kids. We had, like I say, Richard and Ricky, Richard Johnson, Ricky Sanders, both played in the NFL, and both were great, light feet, great kids, bright kids. And I'd go now outside. We had a little Ice Cube McNeil that went on to play Cleveland, a little butterfly that just flew. Then we had a couple other kids, Scott and Greg Moser, that weren't as fast, but were very, very good players. We had what you're looking for to do what we do. We had enough guys that could fly that we gave defenses a lot of problems. Then you have Jim Kelly throwing the football to them, we had exactly what we were looking for. I mean, they were a pleasure to work with and put up a lot of points, made the game exciting. All the stuff you look for in football was possessed in the Houston Gamblers, no question.
In 85, you went to the Denver Gold. Talk a little bit about that, because by that time, the decision had been made to go to the Fall in 86.
Well,
and things were changing rapidly, weren't they?
They really were. Now, in Denver Gold, we still had a season, we had a great season. We got to playoffs. We weren't as talented overall, and certainly Kelly was a great quarterback in Houston. We had some good quarterbacks that played extremely well. Vince Evans, who came from Chicago, was a great player. We had Bob Galliano, who later played for us in Detroit. We had guys that really were more journeymen, but still good players. And then our receivers weren't as talented, but certainly were talented enough to get us into the playoffs. And it was a great time in that we weren't supposed to do much, but did a lot. And I worked for Doug Spedding in the USFL in Denver, and he was very supportive of everything we did. And it was the whole ownership thing was new to him. So from a standpoint of having control of doing what you're doing, it was a great situation. And I had a great staff. As I look back now, June Jones, who's now coaching, well, he did a great job at Hawaii and is now at SMU. And when he left, Greg McMacken took over at Hawaii. He was also on our staff at Denver. And we just have so many guys that keep showing up different places. Joe Herring's now, who was our defensive coordinator, is now a scout with the Buffalo Bills. All these guys were a part of the deal. Pete Rodriguez was our defensive line. He coached special teams in the NFL for years and years. So we had a great group of people that were in the organization that have had continuing great success in football. And so that all makes it fun. That you look back, you got to smile to see all the success that so many people had. And you certainly root for the players. We had a lot of kids in the O-line that later played in the NFL or some that had already played. I was playing up with Portland State. We were up playing Idaho State this year. Their offensive center was a kid by the name of George Yarno. Funny that I would have had George Yarno with the Denver Gold as the offensive center. This was his son that was now playing. That happens, you know, which is a great thing. You know, really it is. And so we're playing Idaho State. And before the game, George Sr., he was now coaching at Washington State. They had a bye date. He shows up. I hadn't seen him since the Denver Gold. So, you know, those are all good things.
You know, I said at the beginning of the program tonight that when I first saw the run and shoot with the Houston Gamblers in 84, it was my third year of coaching junior high football at the time, and I saw one game on television and just totally fell head over heels for the offense, and I've been running some form of that ever since.
Okay, no matter what your listeners think, that makes you a very intelligent man.
Thank you.
No question. And, you know, the key is, like last year, June at Hawaii led the nation in passing at his level. As bad as we were at Portland State last year, we led the league in passing at our level. So something about it, it still works. So you got to be smiling and laughing and saying, this does have some answers. Do you have to have a quarterback? Absolutely. Am I excited about having a quarterback? Every crack out of the box. Do you have to have some receivers? Absolutely. Do you think that anyone that's going to run slug mouth has to have some runners and blockers? Absolutely. So I'm not saying that there's a magical scheme. You still have to have players to do the deal. But if you have players, then you got a real opportunity to have success.
One misconception that I've always come up against over the years, and I'm sure you have too, was that the notion that style of offense is that you couldn't have that great running back.
Yeah, how bad is that? Now, you know, look at the old Houston Gamblers. We had 2,000. Well, one was almost 1,500. There was over 1,000. Todd Fowler, kid who played for us there, later went back to the – well, not back to – went on to the Dallas Cowboys, played for a couple more years. He'd been a tight end coming out of college. And we had two guys like that. It was great. Now, obviously, if you get Barry Sanders, in the NFL. Barry's going to look great in anything you do. But he led the league each year in per carry average that he was in the offense. And like I say, you know, it's easy to coach Barry because he's a freak. He's got unbelievable talent. You don't get a whole bunch of guys like that. So whatever you put him in is going to be very good. But it just goes to show you put a great player in what we do. Once again, he leads the league and does what he does. And it's no question that the running game is incredible because the only difference, philosophically, most teams run to set up the pass. And in our offense, we pass to set up the run. And that's how it works. This year, I was gratified to see that the New England Patriots went unlike so many teams in the NFL, and it would pass 23, 24 times in a row. That's incredible in the NFL. But that sound, as long as it's there, it's very, very sound. You're still moving the ball, you're still doing what you do, and you're setting up the offense to have great success. Great success.
I tell you, Lon, all this is sounding vaguely familiar, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very, very
familiar. All the good stuff, my man, all the good stuff.
It has always struck me, at least from my perspective over the years, is that you like to build things from scratch. You know, being in the United States Football League, the guys that help formulate the rules and everything for the Arena Football League, the World League of American Football, where you were with the New York, New Jersey franchise, it seemed like you enjoy the building aspect of everything.
Well, you know, I think there is a certain degree of what we do that allows you to build something. Then people can go from wherever they want. Like, arena football is changing slightly. I don't want to see them change too much because they're going to screw up the game if they change it too much. But in a small arena like that, it was great to take it and show people that you could really make it an exciting game. Did we have to change rules slightly? Absolutely. But it's a great game. I don't want to see them change too much because if they change it too much, those turn out to be a slugmouth league, and then they'll find that they won't have as much success. And they've made a couple of changes that are marginal, and they want to make too many more. From up until this year, all the base rules that we started with have remained intact. Some of them are still in, most of them are still intact. They're starting to move away and lighten it up, and if they lighten it up too much, they're going to have not as much success as they've had. It's been a great league, and I was happy to have had a hand in developing it from not a chance to where it really has had great success. Football is the best team sport that has ever been invented. And if you just keep it that way and don't try to screw it up too much, you got a chance of having an ongoing success. Let the coaches coach, the players play, and it'll be great.
Amen to that. You did your time with the Lions. You were in the Arena Football League coaching the Detroit Fury, and that's actually where we met that one time.
Exactly. That was good.
I can remember this like it was yesterday. You really treated me very, very nice. And really the whole crux of the conversation starting is I had the same name as one of your friends that was coaching in the Canadian Football League.
And Don Matthews in the Canadian Football League had great success. Now, this can happen to you because your name's Don Matthews. About 2 years ago, he had been coaching up there for years and years. He had great success. He was in Montreal. He got kind of anxiety syndrome. Anxiety syndrome means I can't really make a decision. And finally, he just had to quit coaching. And he's now back living in Oregon. But he was great. He did a great job. And he's as unlike anyone as I could ever imagine having anxiety syndrome. I mean, he was full-fledged, let's get it on, let's go do whatever we do, you know, just make a decision now. And he got to the point where he couldn't make a decision. That our minds are a little screwed up on occasion, I guess. But Don Matthews was a great coach in the Canadian League for years and years, won a whole bunch of Grey Cups, and you'd like him. He's a man's man and hustles the women.
You won a Grey Cup too, didn't you?
Excuse me?
You won a Grey Cup.
Grey Cup that Conridge Holloway was my quarterback in Toronto. And we had it going. And the year that I went to the USFL, actually Houston, Conridge and the Toronto Argonauts won the Grey Cup. And Conridge calls me and said, "Coach, I'm going to get you a Grey Cup ring." I said, "I'm not there anymore." He said, "I know, but you deserve it." I said, "No, no, we're not doing that." But they won it the next year using all the stuff. And Conridge, now assistant athletic director at Tennessee, and you love him. He's a great kid, one of those kids that comes to play, one of those kids that I packed him up one day. I told the newspaper guy, "Conridge can't break 4.9. Conridge comes in. He said, "Did you say that?" I said, "Absolutely." He said, "You think I'm slow?" I said, "Yeah, but you're quick as a cat. You can't tag the guy. That's what I told you. You can't tag him in a phone booth." The little kid had great balance, great quickness, and was a winner. He took our stuff and took it as his own and made us a great winning football team. And then he, more than I think, than any other single individual, took him to the Grey Cup win the next year.
Lon, you got a question for Coach Davis?
What, in your eyes, you know, having been around for years, what do you think of the state of the NFL with free agency, with just these, you know, ridiculous contracts? You know, what are your views on the NFL now?
Well, you know, I think that obviously it's the most exciting game in the United States, so it's pretty tough to screw it up. I thought for a while free agency might blow it, but the fact is, there's so much money for the NFL, I think it's just going to continue to go and go and go. And I do believe that the kids playing a game deserve the money that they're getting because the money is coming to the NFL, and so somebody's going to get it. Either they get it or the owners get it. Well, the owners are always going to get their share because the way it's written, they got a black line at the end of the day. So I say, that's good, you know, make it. The kids are doing a great job, and they're the ones that really are putting the money on the board. The game is so good and so exciting. I don't know who developed the thing from the initial get-go, but they're a lot smarter than I was, I'll tell you for sure. But they've done such a – the great game is so great that it's tough to screw it up. The only way I can see screwing it up is that it becomes – nepotism becomes so great in each, wherever it is, each team, that we somehow figure out a way to screw it up. As long as we still keep it competitive for all the jobs that people are getting, then I think the players themselves will carry the ball. And I think it's tough to even screw it up with nepotism, but I think that there's a possibility that that could occur. Because I keep hearing from guys that are in the league, "Jesus, we got every frigging nephew, you know, so on, doing something." And I hate to see that go too far. But as long as you keep it out of the coaching and out of the players, the rest of it is still going to be a great shot. I mean, I think it's such a great game. And I might be a little prejudiced, but I don't care. That's how I feel about football.
After a time in Hawaii, you're now back really full circle, back at Portland State where it all started.
Yeah. You know, it is kind of one of those things. Hawaii was great, and over there I really didn't do all that much. You know, June's my kid, and he had the program going. He's run. I wouldn't even have gone, but he wanted me to come out. My wife had died, so I thought, okay. I go out. It was great. Had a great time, great people, the whole thing. And then Portland State was talking about dropping football. And so Jerry was talking about wanting to become a head coach. So I called, kind of set the deal up. And then Jerry said, "I go, you got to come with me." Well, you know, I thought maybe it'd take a year to get it going. Well, we weren't real good last year. So I got to stay another year. My plan is we get it going, get it humming like I really truly believe we can, then I don't know that I've had enough because it's a great thing. And you can only do so much golf, and you can only do so much of anything except.
It's just one of those things where you,
yeah, exactly.
You think that you're out, and they draw you back in, huh?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I love it. I love it. I love the kids. Kids are great. We got some great kids here, and I don't like jerks. We had a few that were a little bit oriented to that last year. We get rid of those. We get on with the next thing, and the kids that are playing are sincere kids, and we got to get better. We got to do a better job coaching the whole thing, but that's where we are.
You talk about Jerry Glanville, one of the true characters of the sport. Talk a little about him.
Well, Jerry, you know, he's certifiably nuts. Any guy that goes out and will drive a friggin' NASCAR 200 and plus miles an hour and blow up and get his skin graft and all that stuff because of the fire and still jump right back and drive. He's got to be a little crazy, doesn't he? But he believes in what he does in football, and he's jacked about it, and you know the whole thing. I mean, he's excited about being the head coach, and he does love Oregon, and his wife came up, which was maybe more important than him liking it. She likes it too, so he still has a very soft spot for Detroit because you know that's where initially he was born and all. And he was with the Lions, so he's jacked. He's a Michigan guy, too. I mean, no question he's a Michigan guy. Maybe that's why he's certifiably nuts. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you got to have a couple of screws loose to be from Michigan, that's for sure.
That's all part of the deal.
Yeah, I guess so. Coach, I just want to tell you that to this day, I have a picture of me and you on top of my television. That's one of my most cherished.
I appreciate that. You haven't thrown it in the garbage can or done something with that.
One of these days we'll
see each other again, Donald. And I'm rooting for you guys. Hope everything's going well for you. Now, all I ask is you root for us so we could get some wins on the board.
Oh, we're definitely Viking fans here. Definitely
okay,
Viking
great.
Fans.
And I appreciate you guys doing this. The old USFL, there are a lot of guys that really mean a lot to me. Had so many good friends from the USFL, and most importantly, so many good players that had played for us that were great kids that went on to have great success. And what a great thing it was! It was a great league, and we had great fun with it. I know they call it the $3 league. That's what happens sometimes when you get into litigation. $3 is a win, not a big win, but it's a win.
Yeah. Well, Coach Davis, I want to thank you for calling in tonight. We definitely appreciate it. And, hopefully we'll talk to you again.
All right, gentlemen. Y'all have a good
all
evening.
Right.
My best
all right,
to all
you
the
too.
People in Michigan.
All right, thanks.
You bet. Bye.
All right, that was the legendary Coach Mouse Davis. Line, I told you, man.
Yeah, that was cool. That was cool talking to Coach Davis. Actually, all of them. I mean, you know, all three of the callers that it's been cool. But just talking to Coach Davis, that's just I don't know.
I didn't want to gush too much, but honest to God, what I have done. As a football coach at every level that I have ever coached, even up through now with the Michigan Admirals, everything that I've done as a football coach is a direct result of two people. One is my wife for getting me involved in coaching to begin with, or daring me basically to get into coaching to begin with, and the direct influence of Daryl Mouse Davis. Like I told him, I saw that run and shoot offense for the first time in early 84, and I knew that was what I wanted to do. started doing that in the fall of 84, and in some way, shape, or form, you know, I added my little tweaks here and there over the years, and most people that run that style of offense, you know, they will add their little tweaks, but basically been doing what Mouse done ever since.
Yeah, it was, you know, just hearing some of those names, you know, talking about, you know, Ricky Sanders and, you know, Gerald McNeil. I remember correctly, Gerald McNeil was on the original Tecmo Bowl on Nintendo. Him and Kevin Mack of Cleveland. You know, it's just, you know, hearing those, some of those names of just players that you don't, you know, that have, were great players, that were exciting to watch, but, you know, may never make the Hall of Fame. You know, because,
yeah.
I mean, Gerald McNeil, I mean, he was just a, I mean, he was a rocket. I mean, he, like he was, you know, talking about, you know, Kevin Mack with Cleveland, you know, he just, you know, guys that were fun to watch, that were exciting to watch, that, you know, didn't have Hall of Fame careers, but still, you know, were memorable. You know, and that's just, that was cool. And I gotta get online and find me some Portland State gear, man.
Oh yeah, we definitely gotta. We're Portland State fans here now for sure.
Yeah.
Most definitely. And you know, and I'm still gonna hang on to my Hawaii cap, but I'm gonna have to find me SMU cap too. You know, I gotta represent the guys that have been influences in my coaching life. And you know, like I said, it was a great pleasure to talk to the guy that's been my coaching idol and mentor for all these years, that we do get to talk to him again since I talked to him a few years ago. But
I imagine you're not going to be a Utah fan until after the first week of the season, though.
Well, you know, I've always liked Utah, to be honest with you. You know, I like, definitely, you know, when Urban Meyer was there, you know, there were some things that I saw that maybe I would want it to do, but I better not, you know.
But
I don't like sticking my quarterback out for that kind of punishment, you know.
Yeah, but I imagine you're not going to root for Utah until the second week of the
game. Well, not till the second game, no. after that, Coach Whittingham, I hope you win all the rest of them. But that first one in Ann Arbor, you know, I got to stick with the homeboys. You know, it's you know, it might be a difficult season for the Maize and Blue this year, you know, as we make that transition. But I got to stick with the Maize and Blue, that's for sure. I'll tell you what, we're going to take one last break, and then we'll be right back to close out the show tonight. You're listening to The Locker Room here on Blog Talk Radio and the Admirals Radio Network.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library. So make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
This is Jessica, boss lady of the Michigan Admirals, and you are listening to The Locker Room on Blog Talk Radio and the Admirals Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Locker Room here on Blog Talk Radio and the Admirals Radio Network. Head Coach Donald Matthews of the Michigan Admirals, along with the great lineman, Lon Turner. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I don't know if I've reached great status yet.
Okay, very good. How about that?
I guess I can accept that one. I'll never be the legend. You know,
No, I'm not saying legendary now, you know.
Right.
It's only one legend.
Yeah. Have you talked to him, by the way?
I've had email conversations with him in the past 24 hours, and he did give me a message to give to you. He says that he's become very good at cow tipping. But the thing that is the new thing going around there is in Wyoming is turd tossing.
Yeah, well, I guess it's good he kept the gloves then. You know,
I guess.
I figured Bill would have called in by now. I figured, you know, once American Idol went off, Bill would have called in, but, you know.
Yeah, he in all likelihood had to work tonight, and I'm really sorry that he wasn't able to call in tonight. This has been a great show talking about the 25th anniversary of the start of the United States Football League. Like I said, the United States Football League really it drove up salaries, so that helped the NFL out. It took a lot of things from the United States Football League that we talked about earlier, the instant replay, things like that. The great players that came out from that league and moved on to the NFL after the league folded. You know, Mouse talked about somebody that, you know, we didn't talk about earlier that was, you know, he is of legendary status because he's now in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I guess the first USFL player to be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and that's Jim Kelly. I've always been a great Jim Kelly fan.
Yeah, I was, you know, Jim Kelly's one of those players, you know, kind of like Brett Favre. I didn't really care for him at first, but after a while, you know, you got to respect the skills, you know. So this, yeah, he was a great quarterback, you know. Never didn't get the hardware, but you know, probably one of the him and Dan Marino are probably two of the greatest quarterbacks who never, you know, win a Super Bowl. So, you know, but hey, he got there four times. So I mean, you know, you can't.
There you go. There you go. We want to thank our guest tonight. First of all, thank you, Lon, for calling in tonight and getting a chance to talk to some of these guys. I want to thank our guest that called in tonight, Tim Mazzetti, the coach of the University of Utah, Kyle Whittington, and the legendary Mouse Davis. We definitely want to thank him for calling in tonight. And we hope you enjoyed the show. This will be on the in-demand section of our website at thelockerroom.us, and about half an hour or so after it ends. So if you want to, you know, listen to the show over again and listen to our guests and as they talk about what their remembrances of the league and what they've been doing since the United States Football League, be sure to do that. Next week is back to football. We're going to be talking about, you know, the Admirals and all the stuff that's going on in the sports world today. I want to thank you all for listening tonight. And we're going to end tonight with the theme from the USFL on ESPN. So enjoy that and have a good night, everybody. Thanks for calling in, Lon.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right.
The ESPN Monday Night USFL Football, the Michigan Panthers and Birmingham Stallions live from Legion Field in Birmingham, Alabama.
This is Walter Jackson, outside linebacker of the Michigan Admirals, and you're listening to The Locker Room on Blog Talk Radio and the Admirals Radio Network.